Let's go back to February 1996. Okay, so maybe you're still in your dewy-eyed youth and you're wondering what the heck that suffering cat sound was. But for those of you like me who feel the flush of nostalgia at the first static-filled siren song of dial-up, it takes you back, doesn't it? 1996, when the internet was a miraculous, still a miraculous new world, when only about 20 million Americans had internet access, and those who did spent an average of 30 minutes a month surfing the web. I mean, could we even call it surfing when so many of the websites were rudimentary things like, "Hi, it's Magna," in flashing colorful letters and a picture of a Bart Simpson underneath it? I did that. That was my website in 1994, my first stab at HTML, and yes, I am still very proud of it. But just to drive the point home, Hotmail, the first web-based email service, wouldn't be a thing until July of 1996. So when President Bill Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act of February 1996, all eyes were on the new, shiny information highway. Here's then Vice President Al Gore at the signing.
It is a new flight path to an entirely new world, a world in which we use technology to put us more directly in contact with each other, a world in which our ability to create and receive information will be limited not by the bounds of our technologies, but only by the infinite boundaries of our imagination.
The infinite boundaries of our imagination. Well, President Bill Clinton, though, did predict some bumps on that information highway.
We know the information age will bring blessings for our people and our country. But like most human blessings, we know the blessings will be mixed.
From NPR and WBUR and Meghna Chakrabarty, this is On Point. And Emma Lanzo, I just want to start by asking you, do you feel that flush of nostalgia for the baby internet?
Oh, absolutely. No, hearing the AOL dial-up sound still makes me so excited, right? Because I know I'm about to go online and get, at the time, all sorts of X-Files fan fiction. It's just going to be a great thing.
Wait, so we now officially have to change this show to our mutual X-Files fandom. Okay, I did not see that one coming. All right, okay, stay focused, Magna. We have to talk about Section 230. So yeah, look, back in the day when you had to wait to dial into the internet and you actually like did it over the phone and, you know, little gifs of Bart Simpson were like the highlight of your world, everything seemed really flush and full of possibility, right? And so yet here we are 24 years later, and there is a pitched battle in Washington going on over this little tiny part of a law that people are, you know, are saying is the thing that helped create the modern internet. So let's just start with the simple question. What is Section 230, and why was it in the Telecommunications Act of 1996?
Great question. So Section 230 is the law that sets out the legal protections for all of the technical intermediaries that make online communication possible. So in order to communicate online, whether it's hosting your website with the Bart Simpsons GIF, sending an email, using social media today, we rely on a whole host of technical intermediaries to communicate. You need your website operator, domain name system, search engines, access providers. All of those different intermediaries are passing back and forth what's called user-generated content, our speech, our content that we upload. Section 230 is the law that says those intermediaries are not legally responsible. They won't be held liable if I decide to use their services to do something illegal. Mm-hmm. So for example, if I tweet something defamatory about you, you can, of course, sue me because I've defamed you, but you can't sue Twitter. And you can't sue Twitter's kind of cloud hosting service. You can't sue their domain name provider. And you can't sue the search engine that might pull up that tweet and show it to people.
Mm. You know, when you mentioned your X-Files love, it's so hijacked my brain. I forgot to actually give you a full introduction. So my apologies. Emma Lanzo is director of the Free Expression Project from the Center for Democracy and Technology. It's a nonprofit focused on the intersection between individual rights and technology. Okay, so Section 230, here's the actual text of it. It's in 47 U.S. Code, subsection 230, and it says, quote, "No provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider." Okay, so first of all, what was it about the Telecommunications Act of 1996 that this particular language, why was it put in there back in 96?
So it's an interesting backstory to Section 230. Section 230 was actually introduced originally by Representatives Cox and then Representative Wyden as an alternative to the Communications Decency Act. In the mid-90s, Congress was just becoming aware of the kind of the commercial internet and the potential and promise that it held, but they were also very concerned about, in particular, pornography online and the ability of children to have access to it without any kind of, you know, potential parental supervision or intervention. So the Communications Decency Act, in its main part, was actually a law that intended to require online services to prevent minors from accessing pornography. And it had a couple of different ways it tried to do that. But the upshot was eventually in 1997, the Supreme Court struck down the bulk of the Communications Decency Act, saying in the case Reno versus ACLU, saying that the different requirements that Congress was trying to put on service providers to require them to get age information from users, only ever share indecent content or pornography with adults, violated the Constitution because it would put too many barriers on adults' access to lawful material. So there was that whole conversation going on. And at the same time, there were members of Congress like Cox and Wyden who were thinking, that's not the direction to go. We actually need to think about this online content issue very differently. So Congress kind of combined the two ideas and passed them both into law. And then the court struck down the bulk of the CDA, leaving Section 230 as sort of the last law standing.
Okay. But help me understand one thing, and maybe it's just because it seems I'm having trouble sorting this out, though. So I get it about the concerns about pornography and how that was taken to court, et cetera. But the language is very specific in Section 230, right? It says no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information. Yeah. Tell me more about about that particular decision around that language.
Yes. So what was becoming clear in the early 90s as courts started applying kind of traditional publisher liability law to these nascent online services like Prodigy and CompuServe was that the internet was actually something really different from traditional publishing. There were a couple of cases that really sort of laid out the tension here pretty clearly. On the one hand, you had services like CompuServe, who had online forums or message boards, and they were very hands-off. They were an online service. They gave you access. They hosted the content, and they didn't really do much of anything to moderate it. And in cases looking at potentially illegal material on CompuServe, courts were saying, okay, well, look, they're clearly just this technical intermediary. They have nothing to do with the content. We should not hold CompuServe liable for the illegal content that users are posting. But Prodigy was taking a different approach. They were saying, well, we want our forums, our message boards to actually be moderated spaces. We want them to be functional. We want to take down curse words or off-topic conversations or things that seem like insults or potentially defamatory material. And in a famous case, Stratton Oakmont versus Prodigy, a court looked at all of sort of what Prodigy was doing to moderate content and concluded, this looks a lot like traditional publisher activity, which means traditional publisher law, like we would apply to newspapers or bookstores, should apply to Prodigy, which means if they've made a mistake and left something up that is defamatory, now Prodigy itself is liable for that defamation. So these court cases kind of set up what's been come to be known as the moderator's dilemma. You get put in this position of you either do nothing with user content, you don't address abuse, you don't do moderation, and you avoid risk of lawsuits, or you try to moderate content but become liable for anything that your users post that you miss, or you make the wrong call, or you just don't really understand might actually be illegal. So it created, applying traditional publisher liability to these intermediaries really created a strong disincentive against actually doing the kind of moderation you'd kind of like a service to do to keep the space kind of usable and to address potential abuse.
Okay, so we're going to come back to that in a second. But many people see Section 230 as the, and that blanket sort of liability protection as the thing that allowed the internet and internet companies to flourish. So from October of this year, there was a Senate Commerce Committee hearing. And here's what Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg said on why Section 230 was so important to the early internet.
Now, there's a reason why America leads in technology. Section 230 helped create the internet as we know it. It has helped new ideas get built and our companies to spread American values around the world. And we should maintain this advantage.
So is that true, Emma?
I mean, I would largely agree with that. Section 230 has provided a really clear and stable baseline for different kinds of internet companies of all sorts and of all sizes since it was passed into law in 96. It's made it very easy to for somebody who wants to start a new service, whether it's a new website or a new app, or to be part of kind of the infrastructure of the internet, to know with a lot of clarity what is the legal risk that they run in dealing with user-generated content. And I think a really key point to understand about all of this is that when we're talking about online communication, the scale of communication is so large that there's no way for any of these intermediaries to actually do kind of pre-publication review of all of the material that users want to post.
Well, whether you're running... Yeah, especially if they want to post it immediately, though. I mean, so
exactly.
we got to take a quick break here, Emma. This is so fascinating. We are talking about Section 230, those 26 words that helped create the modern internet and the intense political battle over the future of Section 230, whether, you know, the President of the United States, President Trump, wants to get rid of the whole thing or whether it's high time for some sort of new version of it. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are talking about Section 230, those 26 words in the Communications Decency Act that many folks say helped create the modern internet and subsequently has extracted a lot of bipartisan ire to the point where it might get tucked into the Defense Reauthorization Act and or language to remove Section 230 might get tucked into it. And President Donald Trump absolutely wants to eliminate Section 230. Some Democrats have ideas on how to modernize it. We're talking about why and what needs to be done and how any changes on Section 230 would have an impact on everybody's experience of the internet. And I'm joined today by Emma Lonzo. She is director of the Free Expression Project for the Center for Democracy and Technology. And Emma, I want you to help us understand sort of the political rabbit hole that Section 230 is in right now. But before we do that, let me just play something that the CEO of Twitter, Jack Dorsey, said in October of this year, again, in that Senate hearing on social media content moderation. Here's how he opened his prepared statement.
Section 230 is the most important law protecting internet speech. And removing Section 230 will remove speech from the internet.
So, Emma, what do you think about that? I mean, Dorsey's sort of laying out an absolutist argument for Section 230, that it is the thing that protects the freedom of expression on the internet. So don't mess with it.
Yeah, and I think in a very practical way, Dorsey is right. And the way he's explaining it is the way a lot of folks who are kind of steeped in Section 230 case law and the actual operation of the law would also frame it. It's one thing to understand about Section 230 is it allows website operators, social media companies, and other intermediaries to dismiss lawsuits fairly early in the legal process at the motion to dismiss stage. This means that if somebody tries to bring a lawsuit against a Twitter or a Reddit or a Pinterest about content that's available on their service, that website operator can say to a court pretty early on, before you have hundreds of hours of legal fees and all of the costs of discovery and really getting into a trial, can say to a court pretty early on, there's no case here. There's no way for this intermediary to be held legally responsible for whatever illegal material might be on the site. And that's what makes Section 230 so powerful. It is a very kind of clear and consistent protection that makes services actually willing to host our speech. Mm. If they had to start kind of fighting a federal case or fighting a legal battle about risky posts on their site or posts that just someone disagrees with and wants to bring a lawsuit in order to try to get it taken down, even if ultimately the service provider would be vindicated in court, it would be found they had nothing to do with the illegal content or the content was not in fact illegal, just the process of getting dragged through the court case is going to make sites say, look, we don't want that hassle. We can't afford it, especially for a smaller site. It might literally bankrupt them to go through too many protracted legal battles. And the response from the service provider instead is going to be, we're not hosting it. We're going to take it down. If you tell us you think something's illegal, we'll just take it down, no questions asked, because trying to manage that sort of threat of liability at scale is just overwhelming and would make it really difficult, if not impossible, to run a user-generated content service.
Yeah. So, but here we are, though, in 2020, and have been for several years now, in this world where we have these two facts kind of meeting head-to-head about free speech on the internet, and yet it is at the same time being moderated. The content is being moderated by Silicon Valley companies, and that has caused a huge, and I actually would say overall, a correct debate about how we want to regulate this vital resource, okay? Mm-hmm. But the way that debate's being played out in Washington really depends on what side of the aisle you're on. So let me just be clear about something that I garbled a little earlier. The President Trump, just recently this month, threatened to veto the reauthorization of the annual defense bill. It's a $1 trillion military spending bill if Section 230 does not get repealed. Okay, so he has put the Pentagon's budget on the line in his desire to get rid of Section 230. Now, he has support from Republican members of Congress. So first of all, let's just talk about what are the Republican concerns about Section 230.
Yeah, it's a good question. The Trump administration has really been on a months, if not years, long campaign against Section 230. And a lot of the concerns that they raise and that some Republican members of Congress raise have to do with this kind of unfounded in any sort of research, but this claim of anti-conservative bias in how especially sites like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube moderate content. They're concerned about conservative commentators getting deplatformed, and they assert that there's a kind of persistent anti-conservative, anti-right-wing approach to how companies moderate content. Again, that hasn't really been borne out in any research. And what we see it coming up in Congress is our proposals to amend Section 230 to remove this liability shield for services that take down anything other than a pretty narrow category of content. So maybe they'd still have Section 230 protection for taking down things like pornography or excessively violent content, but not for taking down content like disinformation or hate speech. We've also seen proposals to revoke Section 230 protection for so-called editorializing on user-generated content. This is a direct threat to the ability for sites to do things like fact-checking or labeling of content. For example, all of the labeling that Twitter and Facebook were doing around the election to say, this claim of victory is disputed, or you know, the race hasn't been called yet, or any of the other labels that the services were adding to commentary, including from the president himself. So especially in the past couple of months, the focus from some on the right has really seemed to be tied directly into all of the issues around election misinformation. And in some ways, trying to tie social media companies' hands from actually fighting things like disinformation and hate speech around the election.
Mm. Well, let's listen to a little bit of an exchange between Texas Senator Republican Ted Cruz and Jack Dorsey, CEO of Twitter, because there was a moment in the October Commerce Committee hearing where Senator Cruz repeatedly asked Dorsey about a tweet from the New York Post that Twitter took down. It had to do with Hunter Biden's their reporting over Hunter Biden's laptop hard drive. And so the senator kept asking about over and over again, why'd you do that? It was a mistake. Why'd you block them? Blah, 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 blah. And then Cruz said this.
Mr. Dorsey, who the hell elected you and put you in charge of what the media are allowed to report and what the American people are allowed to hear? And why do you persist in behaving as a Democratic super PAC, silencing views to the contrary of your political beliefs?
And here is how Dorsey responded.
We realize we need to earn trust more. We realize that more accountability is needed to show our intentions and to show the outcomes.
Thank you,
so I hear the concerns and acknowledge them, but we want to fix it with more transparency.
Emma, what do you hear in that? What do you hear in that exchange?
A lot of things. One thing I think Senator Cruz kind of glosses over in his assertion that, you know, that Twitter is deciding what the media can publish. The New York Post has its own website. People can go to the New York Post's website to see the material that it is publishing. There are obviously the kind of access that people have to different sorts of speakers and information outlets through social media is really important. And I think people are right to focus on how do social media sites in particular kind of affect our information environment writ large. But Twitter's decision was not the be-all and end-all of whether the New York Post could publish. The New York Post gets to use the internet and post its articles online and is protected by Section 230 when it hosts user-generated content, just the same as Twitter is. So there's, I think, sometimes a little bit of an overhyping of the decisions made by a Facebook or a Twitter being the end of speech for other speakers. There are, in fact, lots of other ways to get a message out. Mm. But I think it's also, you know, I'm glad to hear Dorsey talking about transparency. It's certainly something that folks in civil society like myself have been calling on especially the big internet platforms for years to be kind of more clear and more transparent about what their policies are and how they apply them. Because I think if I can find a kind of a kernel of really important policy concern in all of this, it's people don't like feeling like there's arbitrary decisions being made about information and about who gets to speak. We don't accept it at all from our government under the First Amendment, and we don't like it when we feel like that's what's happening on platforms that we otherwise want to use and on services that we want to rely on as a way to access information. So I think the transparency direction is an important one to go and to be able to explain why is a service like Twitter making these decisions to, in this case, not allow people to link to certain articles. People will want to, that's a big decision to take, and people will want to understand how a company makes a decision like that in that case and maybe not in another case.
So we're going to come back to this issue of transparency being part of the solution and whether or not Jack Dorsey and Mark Zuckerberg are sincere in their desire for it. So we're going to come back to that in just a second here. But quickly, help me help clarify something, Emma, because you said the New York Post or any media outlet is allowed to put user-generated content on its website and be protected by Section 230. Would those same protections apply if they put it in the actual newspaper?
So if they, New York Post will be liable directly for any content that it authors, whether that goes in the newspaper or they post it on their own website, right? If it's their article and they post something defamatory in their article, that's on them. That's their responsibility as the kind of the speaker of that information. But if at the bottom of that article or at the bottom of any article, you know, about a public figure or anybody else, they have a comment section and a user decides to post something defamatory in the comment section, that's not New York Post's liability, right? That's where Section 230 would kick in and would say, you're trying to host a user-generated comment forum as part of your website. And as far as the user content goes, that is not something that the newspaper is expected to review before it gets published on their website.
Okay. Of course, one of the primary and most important differences is that the New York Post, or even the New York Times, does not have 2 billion plus users, right? And I mean, like the scale is part of the issue here. So we spoke to James Steyer, founder and CEO of Common Sense Media. Of course, it's a nonprofit that advocates for safe technology and media for children. And also, full disclosure, he's also brother of former Democratic presidential candidate Tom Steyer. But here is James Steyer's critique of Section 230.
This is a get-out-of-jail-free card. This means that the major social media platforms, which in Facebook's case have more than 2 billion users, bigger than Christianity itself, are not held liable at all for the content on their platforms. All sorts of content that would never be allowed on the radio like this, would never be allowed on TV, would not be allowed on newspapers. It's all well and good under Section 230 when it comes to the social media platforms because they have a get out of jail free card, and that has to stop.
Now, Emma, this is the primary argument from the left, if I can put it that way, or from Democratic circles. I'm not even sure I could actually distinguish between parties on this one, but like that there's just there by having no regulation or rules. It's opened the floodgates for all of us to be drowning in the sort of horrible cesspools of, you know, misinformation and vile content that are online.
Yes. Yeah. I think what we see from a lot of folks on the left, especially in Congress, is a focus on, you know, sites aren't taking enough things down. They're not taking enough action to prevent abuse. And that could include things like hate speech or disinformation, but also issues that run, you know, directly into core civil rights laws like discriminatory ad targeting for housing or credit or employment ads. I think something that's really, really important to bear in mind, though, is that the law is never going to be able to require these companies to take down speech that is lawful. And the United States Constitution protects an awful lot of speech. So a lot of the things that we've been talking about, like hate speech in the United States, disinformation of many kinds, a lot of the sort of election misinformation that we were seeing circulate, you know, just last month, and in fact still today, most of that is actually constitutionally protected speech. And so there is not really a direct route for Congress to say, you know, intermediaries, thou shalt take a stronger stance on disinformation without being able to identify like actually illegal content that the companies might be liable for. So we're left in this fairly, you know, what for I think a lot of people is a fairly frustrating position of people wanting the companies to do more in some way, to take action against what seems like really awful and abusive content that people don't want to see in, you know, kind of as easily accessible as it is on their services. But there's a real limit to the actual direct regulation that you could bring to bear to a lot of that speech.
Because of the Constitution, but it seems as if though constitutionally over time, there have been regulations that shape that still protect speech while also putting the brakes on some forms of speech.
Yes, but it's important to realize just kind of how limited what is restricted under the law can be. So hate speech is, I think, a really good example here in the U.S. So we have laws against things like incitement to violence or threatening people, you know, with an intent to make them feel fear, or kind of harassment that is so intense and targeted that it rises to the level of criminal harassment. But when Congress tried to pass a law that state tried to pass a law kind of banning all cross-burning, that was struck down by the Supreme Court, who said, you know, we understand that the intent is to capture the fact that burning a cross is often used in an incredibly intimidating and threatening and hateful sort of way, but without actually including that intent to threaten and intimidate a person, the law is too broad. Mm. And it would prevent kind of cross-burning that didn't have this sort of intimidating or threatening intent.
So, Emma, hang on here for just a second. We're going to come back after a quick break and talk about what to do about Section 230. So we'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and tomorrow on the show...
There is a nice crowd in the house, too, at the SCG. Just bunts it straight down the ground, and that is the end of...
Okay, so that sound from an Australian cricket match this week with tens of thousands of real fans actually in the stadium together, that wasn't, like, recording of fans cheering elsewhere. They were together in the stadium because Australia has done a tremendous job of beating back the coronavirus pandemic down to almost no cases across the entire country. And so we're going to talk about how Australia did that. And we want to know about the differences you see in Australia's response to this winter surge of coronavirus and the U.S. response, lessons you think the U.S. can learn from other countries, and whether or not you think it's actually too late here. Call us at 617-353-0683 and leave us a message about whether or not you think in the United States people will be able to return to sports stadiums to watch their favorite teams play anytime soon. Again, 617-353-0683. You're going to learn lessons from Australia. Well, this hour we are talking about Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. It's the 26 words that many say helped give birth to the modern internet, because it provides a great deal of liability protection for internet companies on user-generated content that appears on their site. It's also the source of a great deal of debate over whether the law, as written, is right for the internet of 2020. And I'm joined today by Emma Lonzo. She's director of the Free Expression Project from the Center for Democracy and Technology. So, Emma, you've been excellent in sort of giving us the history of Section 230, walking us through the various political arguments against it now. So I want to spend the rest of the show talking about solutions. Because first of all, like, the first time this was put into law was a quarter century ago. So here again is Jim Steyer, CEO of Common Sense Media. Again, they advocate for safe media and technology for kids. He's also a professor of law, particularly on the First Amendment, at Stanford University. And he said his preferred solution, just start from scratch. No more Section 230.
There are some piecemeal solutions in Congress that are beginning to address the issues of Section 230. But let's be honest. This is something that was written 25 years ago. There was no iPhone. There was no Facebook. There was no Snapchat or Instagram. So the idea that a law that was written for that era now applies thoughtfully to the challenges we face in 2020 and 2021 is insane.
So, Emma, this is the one of the most important points to explore, because the metaphor that comes to my mind is, you know, maybe we shouldn't be applying. It's like trying to apply emission standards or the concept of like how do you regulate an internal combustion engine of a Model T to a Tesla world. Right. Like it's just like so different that you can't even compare the two. And perhaps the best thing is to start with an entirely new regulatory framework that is right for the world we live in now. What do you think about that as a place to start?
Well, I think it would have a lot of potentially unintended consequences. And it's sort of what we've heard from both President Trump and President-elect Biden, this idea of repealing Section 230 or revoking it, is I get the appeal of the idea of sort of taking a sweeping approach to a big complex problem. But what we know about content moderation and regulation online is that it is incredibly complex and the risk of unintended consequences is really severe. So one of the big unintended consequences, I think, if you did a kind of wholesale sweep out of Section 230 and started from scratch, you're going to end up making the companies that already exist and have dozens or hundreds of lawyers on staff much better positioned to navigate that new world than the hundreds and thousands of smaller companies and smaller providers that are out there. Totally changing the liability framework for an industry would have enormous ramifications, and a lot of small players would just not be able to handle the uncertainty, the legal risk, or whatever that new regime was. So as we're all at the same time talking about online content moderation issues, there's a lot of focus on kind of concentration of corporate power and competition and antitrust concerns around some of the biggest companies. I think actually taking away Section 230 would be one of the surest ways of kind of baking those giant companies into our internet ecosystem on a sort of permanent basis. I think you'd really end up making it a lot harder for smaller services and alternatives, sites with a different approach to handling user content, a different approach to kind of the services they were providing, be much harder for those kinds of small services to navigate the new regime.
Okay. So you're not of the burn it down ilk, point taken. But do you think that it does need modernization?
So I think the conversation really needs to go to places where we're talking very specifically about particular problems. Talking about kind of all content moderation writ large, it gets us to a very kind of confused place very quickly. There are a lot of things that currently online services do within the Section 230 framework. There are questions about how you respond to illegal content, you know, court orders that you get from a court saying it has judged this statement to be defamatory, needs to come down. Questions about kind of detecting and reporting illegal content like child sexual abuse material or terrorist propaganda. And then all of the questions we've been talking about of moderating that category of lawful but awful content, content where the government isn't really going to be able to regulate it directly anyway, but we as people still really want services to take action to address abuse. Those are different kinds of problems, and trying to address them all in kind of a single quick fix to Section 230 is, I think, destined to fail.
Okay,
so I really think it's...
No, go ahead. Finish your thought. Go ahead.
I really think it's important to kind of break it down into the different pieces. What is the problem that we're trying to address?
Okay, so let's do that a little bit. So first of all, by talking for a second about actual proposals that are in Congress, like the PACT Act, right, which is a bipartisan proposal that's been put forward by Republican Senator John Thune and Democratic Senator Brian Schatz. They're the co-sponsors of it, and the PACT Act purports to update Section 230 to increase transparency in how content moderation is done and, interestingly, accountability for the companies when they're not even following their own content moderation rules for the for those tech companies. So just for a second, here's Senator Thune speaking on the Senate floor about the PACT Act this summer.
One reason that Section 230 has become so controversial is that internet platforms have actively cultivated the notion that they are merely providing the technology for people to communicate and share their thoughts and ideas. But the reality is somewhat different. The truth is, websites have a strong incentive to exercise control over the content each of us sees, because if they can present us with content that will keep us engaged, we will stay on that site longer.
Now, Emma, I think that it's virtually impossible to argue against that last part of what Thune was saying, right? They need, in the attention economy, Twitter, Facebook, all of them, they want our eyes on their websites. And so this introduces a new little wrinkle here. So perhaps maybe, I mean, Facebook, it's been Facebook, it's been pretty exhaustively reported on all the times in which they have actually either changed their content moderation policy or made exceptions for certain posts because, you know, they just didn't want to take them down. So what about this idea of creating a new accountability structure when the companies themselves veer away from their own rules?
Yeah, it's an interesting idea, and one that I think needs to be looked at carefully under the First Amendment. So we have to remember that these are private actors. These are, you know, businesses, companies, or sometimes even just people running websites and making editorial decisions about what is the content that they do and don't want to host. I totally agree that it is very frustrating when you see a service make an arbitrary decision, or what seems to be an arbitrary decision. But, you know, the New York Times can make an arbitrary decision about what letters to the editor it wants to report. A bookstore can make an arbitrary decision about what books it does and doesn't want to stock. And I think that's the kind of case law that would be applied to any law by Congress that's trying to sort of instill a particular approach to content moderation on a company, or potentially even to this idea of holding them to the promises that they make. Mm. You know, I think it's worth discussion, and certainly worth, you know, considering what are the kinds of information that we as people who are using these sites, or whose access to information ends up getting shaped and affected by them, what are the information we want to see from these companies to understand better what are they doing, how are they making these decisions, and what effect that has on kind of the larger media ecosystem. But I do think Congress needs to be very careful in how it thinks about what a law in that area might look like, because there's sort of this looming First Amendment issue about the government essentially dictating editorial practices for private actors.
Yeah. So you talked a little earlier about specific solutions for specific problems. We talked to Matt Perrault, who's now the director of the Center on Science and Technology Policy at Duke University. In a previous life, he was director of public policy at Facebook. And he is not a fan of repealing 230, but reforming it and supplementing it, in fact, outside of Section 230 with other protections, like specifically regarding voter misinformation, maybe bolstering federal criminal law around voter misinformation. And Perrault told us right now there's no federal law prohibiting providing false information about voting, like, for example, what qualifications you even need to vote.
Those laws exist at the state level, but they don't currently exist at the federal level. And a federal law that prohibits voter suppression, that criminalizes certain speech that results in suppressing voting, would not be subject to a Section 230 defense. If there was a law, a federal criminal law prohibiting certain kinds of voter suppression, and you found that a company like Facebook or YouTube or Google or News Corp were engaged in voter suppression itself and violated that federal criminal law, Section 230 would not be a defense for those platforms.
That's Matt Perrault, director of the Center on Science and Technology Policy at Duke University. Now, Emma, this seems like what you're talking about, perhaps a specific solution for a specific kind of problem, but it also feels a little bit, or maybe a lot, like a whack-a-mole approach to this to me.
It's an interesting idea for sure. And I think Matt's exactly right that Section 230 has never prevented intermediaries from facing federal criminal law prosecution. There has always been an exception in the statute that says if a website operator or any other intermediary has violated federal criminal law, they can be prosecuted. That's always been the case. And so making it's one strategy we've seen from Congress, making changes to federal criminal law as a way to kind of avoid the 230 question entirely. I think the question for this approach would be, how much of the concerning behavior, in this case, election misinformation and voter suppression specifically, would actually fall under that new kind of law? I think Matt was talking about, you know, when the platforms themselves are engaged in the voter suppression, and they're, you know, it's worth studying and investigating what is the like kind of what is the activity directly attributable to the platforms themselves that might fit under that kind of law. But I think a lot of the problem that folks are concerned about is not intentional activity by the services at all, but the failure to be able to do the whack-a-mole and catch all of the different instances of people trying to engage in voter suppression by posting content on their platforms. Yeah. So it's where you have to really, it might address some parts of the problem for sure. And especially if there are bad actor websites out there who are doing things like very intentionally to try to suppress the vote, then a law like that might be really useful. Mm. And I think we'd also need other tools to address other parts of the problem.
Okay. So all of those tools though seem to rely on information, right? Like, as you've said before, transparency, maybe being the first step. So Matt Perrault also said this to us. He wants more transparency in terms of decisions made by these companies and wants to actually give them legal protections for sharing data with reputable researchers.
What we want to do is educate people and reduce distribution of problematic content. Are these interventions actually successful? That seems like the kind of question where we would want data. We want to understand how do we actually take positive steps to address content that we view to be problematic. And I don't think sufficient data exists. One of the reasons that sufficient data doesn't exist is that platforms face liability when they share data, even when they share data with reputable researchers.
So, Emma, we've just got about a minute and a half left. And let's just come to the agreement that transparency would be a great place to start. And maybe this is where the government can actually, like, use its regulatory power to encourage transparency. I would also say, though, it has to be from the government that forces this, because I do not believe for a second that Mark Zuckerberg or Jack Dorsey would willingly give this information out. That data is their bread and butter. And historically, they've been extremely reluctant to let people peek into the black box.
And this is where I think what Congress should really prioritize is baseline federal privacy legislation that is a kind of comprehensive data protection law for Americans and how our data is collected and used by these companies. This concept of enabling access to access to data for researchers could be part of that comprehensive privacy law. But what we, you know, going back to the point you were raising earlier about the business model and kind of the push for continual engagement, it all comes back to a kind of behavioral advertising business model. Mm-hmm. That's something that you don't need to touch Section 230 to address at all. You look at something like federal privacy legislation that puts real limits on the collection and use and sale of people's data to advertisers, and you start addressing some of the really pernicious dynamics in the online information ecosystem without having to sit and assess the content of every single post. I think that Congress taking a hard look at what companies are doing with data and putting some real protections in place for people, including making sure that the privacy law enables access to independent researchers, yeah, would be it's a fundamental first step.
Well, Emma Lonzo is director of the Free Expression Project from the Center for Democracy and Technology. Emma, it's been absolutely a fascinating conversation. Thank you so very much. And my last reminder to you is that the truth is out there.
Thank you so much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.